D. Irene texts Huck, "What does D mean?" She wonders if it was just a typo or maybe Destiny's new sign-off. Huck texts back, "D for difficult." She must have been a real humdinger on the phone because Destiny is tough. Great, Irene thinks. D for difficult. She starts the day with a positive attitude. The Goshens are from New York City. Possibly they're caught up in the rat race that is Manhattan. The father works in finance or advertising. Maybe the mother is a fashion editor. Do people in New York have other kinds of jobs? Irene tries to think of characters in movies she's seen. Architect, elite private school headmaster, museum curator, bohemian artist, editor-in-chief, publicist, restaurateur, Broadway actress. Irene gets two coffees and two sausage biscuits from Provisions. Meredith, the owner, has seen her enough times that she now waves. Irene stops there as a show of kindness toward Huck. He makes breakfast for Maya every day, but many times forgets to eat himself. And besides, the sausage biscuit is delicious. Irene is starting to gain back some of the weight she lost. The boat is tied up at the dock before Irene arrives, which has never happened before. Huck is watching her as she approaches. She figures he's here early because of the difficult clients. He takes the coffee and biscuits from her, then helps her down into the boat.
"There's something I need to tell you," he says.
"Something about the clients?" She raises her eyebrows.
"My friend Rupert called over the weekend to tell me that Paulette and Douglas Vickers have been taken into custody by the FBI.
"What?"
"They were on St. Croix with Doug's sister," Huck says. "The FBI tracked them down and arrested them."
"On what charges?"
"Real estate fraud," Huck says. "Financial fraud."
"Well, yes," Irene thinks. "Of course." She wonders if the Vickerses were somehow responsible for the helicopter crash. Was Paulette Vickers the kind of person who could kill three people, then pick up one of the men's widows at the ferry and describe the delights of the island?
"They'll find out what she knows," Huck says. "She'll likely lead them to Todd Croft."
"Real estate fraud," Irene says. She thinks about the dummy driveways on the way up to Russ's villa. "Financial fraud."
"I didn't want to tell you anything until I heard back from Agent Vasco," Huck says. "She left me a message late last night after I was asleep. I thought it might be time to start worrying."
"Is it?" Irene says. Her wheels are spinning. Of course it is. Real estate fraud, Todd Croft, the money in Rosie's drawer. Paulette knows far, far more than she's saying, although likely she's just a pawn manipulated by Todd Croft, and maybe Russ as well.
"No, AC," Huck says, "no. Agent Vasco told me it's an ongoing investigation, and if she has any other questions, she'll be in touch."
"So there's nothing we should do?" Irene says. She wonders if the FBI knows she's working with Huck, and if so, what do they think about that? Does it seem suspicious? Does it seem like Huck and Irene are part of the conspiracy with Russ and Paulette Vickers? Should Irene quit? She doesn't want to quit. She takes a breath of the morning air and tries to calm down. She has done nothing wrong. Huck has done nothing wrong. The FBI agents know this.
"Nothing we should do, nothing we can do," Huck says. "We just have to wait until they find Croft. But I wanted you to be aware."
"Yes, thank you," Irene says. She takes Huck's left hand, the one with the missing pinky, and squeezes it. "Please tell me everything you know. Don't spare me because you think I can't handle it. I'm tough."
"That you are, Angler Cupcake," Huck says. "But I'm happy to give you today off if you want to go home and mull this over."
"Don't be ridiculous," Irene says. "If I do go home, I will mull this over, and what good will that do? I'd much rather be on the boat."
"I feel exactly the same way," Huck says, "even if these people are difficult."
Irene holds the ropes, smiling, as the Goshens approach. What she told Huck is true. She is tough. This family can't throw anything at her that she can't handle. But when she sees them, Her heart sinks. There's the mother, a pretty but sour-looking woman, blonde, thin, mid-40s. She's followed by a teenage daughter, a younger, prettier, angrier version of the mother. Trailing behind them with a bounce in his step is the son. He's maybe 13 or 14 years old, and he's completely bald. The mother's name is Galen Goshen, the daughter is Alter, and the son is Niles. Niles, Galen announces, has just finished 18 rounds of chemo. He has leukemia, Galen informs Irene, and this last round of chemo is either going to put him in remission or it isn't. She says this right in front of Niles, who shrugs.
I want to catch a fish, he says. A big one. Something I can hang on the wall.
He's frail, Galen says. Yes, Irene can see that. He's white as chalk, and his arms and legs are like sticks. His blue eyes are sunken on his face, but they're bright and lively, and he hasn't stopped smiling.
Huck says, 4 to 6 feet today.
4 to 6 feet isn't terrible, but going into the wind, it will be a jarring ride. Even Irene hasn't gotten used to the teeth rattling that occurs when the boat smacks the trough of a wave. More than once she has gone home sore from tensing her muscles for so long. She can't imagine this kid surviving the ride to the drop-off 6 miles south. He'll be broken into pieces by the time they're ready to cast a line. But if they stay inshore, they won't catch a big fish. Nothing big enough to mount, anyway.
4 to 6 feet is too big for an offshore trip, Irene says. We'll stay inshore today and catch plenty of fish.
Niles seems happy with this, and Galen and Alter look like they couldn't care less.
Galen says, Certainly you have a life preserver for Niles?
Life preservers are under the seat behind me, Huck says. We have one to fit the boy, though for an inshore trip, we won't go faster than 10 knots, so we probably won't need it.
I was clear with the woman on the phone,
Galen says, and before she can finish her sentence, Irene is pulling out a life preserver for Niles. D is for difficult. Niles sits next to Huck at the wheel as Huck explains the dash, shows Niles the fish finder, and points off the port and starboard sides, identifying the other islands. Irene checks the light tackle rods, then sits on the stern bench next to Galen and Alter, who are whispering angrily back and forth. Irene doesn't want to eavesdrop. As Huck told her early on, family drama rarely stops because people are out on a fishing charter, and it's absolutely none of their concern. However, it's impossible not to overhear. The daughter, Alter, is turning 18 sometime after the family returns to New York, and Alter wants her mother to allow her to throw a party in the house, apartment, for 100 people with a DJ and a keg.
No, no, and no, Galen says. It's me saying no, but it's also building security saying no. A DJ won't work. 100 kids dancing to a DJ won't work. We'll get evicted.
What about Pineland? Alter says. She had that exact party on the fourth floor 2 years ago.
Pineland's father bribed Mr. Sue, Galen says.
So there's the answer, Alter says. You bribe Mr. Sue.
I have neither the desire nor the spare cash, Galen says. Your brother's treatment.
I knew that was the real reason, Alter says. It's Niles' fault I can't have a party.
Well, what exactly are Niles and I supposed to do while you throw this party in our home?
I don't know, Alter says. Check into a hotel?
She laughs.
Niles will probably be in the hospital anyway, and you'll be at his bedside, so what does it even matter?
Irene can't stand to hear another word. She moves to the captain's seat. Niles is now on his knees on the bow banquette, earbuds in. He's as still and majestic as a figurehead. The earbuds, she supposes, are useful for blocking out his mother and sister. Irene leans into Huck.
They're fighting back there.
Huck nods to let Irene know he's heard her, but he doesn't seem to care. Maybe he's thinking about Agent Vasco. Or, more likely, he's trying to pick a good spot to anchor and cast.
The engine noise makes most conversations impossible, and yet the mother and daughter's discussion has escalated to a screaming match. It's impossible to ignore them.
I'll just ask Dad to pay for it then.
Be my guest. See how far that gets you.
Bitter, because Misty is way cooler than you.
Misty is 26 years old. She should be cooler than me.
I'm calling him now and telling him to book me a plane ticket home. I don't want to be here. The only reason we're here is because of Niles.
Selfish little.
I have children. I'm going to love them all equally.
Sick, Alter.
I don't care,
Alter screams.
I hate you and I hate Niles.
Finally, Huck leans over to Irene.
I know it's difficult, but you have to let them go. They obviously have things to work through.
Irene wipes away the tears that are rolling down her cheeks. She's crying for them, but also for herself and for all families that have been broken. Turns out, she's not as tough as she thought. When it sounds like Galen and Alter might actually come to blows, Galen grabs Alter's phone and holds it over her head, threatening to throw it overboard. Irene moves up to the bow with two light tackle rods. She touches Niles on the back. When he turns to see Irene holding both rods, his face lights up. Irene feels more tears building behind her eyes, but she'll be damned if she's going to cry in front of Niles. This last round of chemo is either going to put him in remission or it isn't. It's going to put him in remission, Irene thinks, and right now she's going to put this kid on a fish. A higher power must be with them, because on his third cast, Niles gets a bite, and Irene can tell just by the bow of the rod that it's something big. But what? There aren't too many big fish to be found inshore, at least not that Irene has experienced firsthand. Niles has a natural instinct of what to do. He reels with surprising tenacity and lets the spool go when the fish runs. He keeps the rod tip up and the handle pressed into his jutting hip bone.
What's it gonna be? Niles asks.
I'm not sure, Irene says. Huck comes to check on them.
Tarpon, from the looks of it, he says. Big one.
Sure enough, a little while later, Niles Goshen reels in a tarpon that is a big fish by anyone's standards.
I didn't think it was the season for tarpon, Irene says.
It's not really, Huck says, but once in a while, the universe throws you a favor.
They're going to take the tarpon home. Huck gives Galen the card of a taxidermist who can stuff and mount it. Galen looks relieved and defeated. Alter is either asleep or pretending to be asleep behind her sunglasses. Galen pulls Irene aside.
You have a good man there,
she says, nodding at Huck. It's clear how much he cares about you. I hope you don't take that for granted. Irene can't think of how to respond. He's not my man? We're not together? I'm just the mate on his boat? What if Irene were to tell Galen that, back on the first of the year, she had been a married magazine editor living in Iowa City, but then her husband was killed in a helicopter crash and his secret life was revealed? Galen wouldn't believe it. But if she did believe it, she might understand that everyone has her baggage and her sad stories. What differentiates people is how they choose to deal with them. Irene has done pretty well, she thinks, assuming the FBI aren't waiting on the dock when they get back. I take nothing for granted, Irene says. On the way back to Cruise Bay, the sky darkens and there's one loud thunderclap, followed by a torrential downpour. Irene hands the Goshens a couple of waterproof ponchos to hold over their heads. They are squeaking and squealing like they're going to melt. As Irene stands under the canvas bimini with Huck, she catches sight of Niles kneeling on the bow. His arms are open, his head back. He's embracing the earth and all of her aspects. It's just rain, he seems to be saying. I will survive it. The Goshens disembark early. They've barely been on the water for 2 hours, and Irene feels a strange melancholy watching them go. She realizes she'll never know what happens to the Goshen family. Will Alter have her birthday party? Will Niles live to be an adult? Will he hang the tarpon he caught off the coast of St. John in his home and gaze on it with pride in his 50s, in his 60s? Irene will be forgotten, lost, as soon as tomorrow or the next day. He will never know how hard Irene was rooting for him. "Wow," she says to Huck. She's wet and cold for the first time since she's been here.
"D," he says, "for difficult."
"There's no charter tomorrow, correct?"
"Correct," Huck says. "You get a day off, unless something comes up at the last minute, which has been known to happen."
Irene nods and wraps her arms around herself. She's shivering. Huck notices and holds his arms open. She stares at him.
"I'm just offering you a hug," Huck says. "That was tough on you, and the news I greeted you with was no picnic either."
Irene takes a tentative step toward him. He wraps his arms around her. It has been, well, a long time since a man held her like this. Russ, before he left for his business trip after Christmas, had he hugged Irene or kissed her goodbye? No, she remembers. She had been in Coralville returning some Christmas presents for Millie. She had been angry at Russ for leaving over the new year, and as punishment, she had denied him a proper goodbye. She tries to remember what Christmas had been like. It was just the two of them in the morning in front of the tree, opening gifts. They had talked to each of the boys on the phone, and they had joined Millie for the Christmas lunch served at Brown Deer. Had they been intimate? Had they hugged and kissed? They'd held hands, she remembers, during the Christmas Eve service at First Presbyterian. That had been nice, Irene supposes, but it hadn't offered the comfort or the rush of this hug. Irene fits into Huck's arms perfectly. His body is solid and warm. Can she trust him? She feels like the answer is yes. But she would have said exactly the same thing about Russell Steele. She would have said Russ was beyond reproach. "Let me take you to dinner tonight," Huck says in her car. "Maya is with theirs, and I have an idea. We'll go over to St. Thomas." St. Thomas is bigger, and they can be anonymous. For some reason, this suits Irene better than being seen out in Cruise Bay, where everyone knows Huck and might guess who Irene is. "Okay," she says. Irene meets Huck back at the dock at 6:30. He told her to dress up, and so she's wearing a spring green linen sheath with a belted middle, a dress she bought for Baker's high school graduation 13 years earlier, right around the time that Russ met Rosie, although she tries to put this thought out of her mind. Huck is wearing a blue button-down shirt, ironed khakis, and if Irene isn't mistaken, there's a navy blazer folded across the back of the captain's seat. This is a real date. Huck has wine on the boat. He pours her a glass of cake bread Chardonnay. She can't believe he remembered what kind of wine she likes, and he opens a beer for himself.
"We aren't going far," he says. "Just over to the yacht club in Red Hook. 15 minutes.
They cruise out, nice and easy, across Sir Francis Drake Channel as the sun sets. Irene considers sitting in the bow and letting the wind catch her hair. It's out of its braid tonight. But instead, she sits next to Huck where she can listen to the music, Jackson Browne singing Running on Empty. The sky glows pink and blue and gold. Huck is humming. Irene's wine is crisp and cold. There is nothing wrong with this moment. The world is a strange and mysterious place, Irene thinks. How is it possible that Russ's web of deceit and his secret second life led Irene here? She laughs at the absurdity of it. Huck never met Russ, but Russ certainly knew that Huck existed. What would Russ think if he could see Huck and Irene now? It turns Irene's mind into a pretzel just considering it. They pull into a slip at the St. Thomas Yacht Club, and a cute young man in white shorts and a green polo hurries over to help with the ropes. He offers Irene a hand up to the dock.
"Captain Huck," he says. "Good to see you again, sir. It's been a while." "Good to see you, Seth," Huck says. "Are we all set inside?"
"Yes, sir," Seth says. "They're ready for you. Enjoy your dinner."
Huck offers Irene his arm and walks her down the dock. He's wearing his blazer now, and Irene is soothed by how at ease he seems and how gentlemanly he is as he opens the door to the club and ushers Irene inside. The hostess, a stunning young West Indian woman, greets Huck with a kiss and introduces herself as Jacinda to Irene. Then she leads Huck and Irene to a table by the front window that overlooks the docks and the water. Irene can see the twinkling lights of St. John in the distance. Theirs is the only table set. They are the only people in the dining room. Is it always this empty?
The kitchen normally isn't open tonight, Huck says, but they owe me a favor.
So they are having a private dinner, the whole club, all to themselves.
The prime rib is very good here, Huck says. I don't know about you, but I'm sick of fish.
They eat like royalty. Warm rolls with sweet butter, organic greens with homemade papaya vinaigrette, prime rib, baked potato with lots of butter and sour cream, and for dessert, sabayon and berries. Huck and Irene drink wine with dinner, then end with a sipping rum, a 25-year-old El Dorado that is even better than the Flor de Caña, Huck says. They do not talk about the Vickers' arrest or what it might mean. They don't talk about Russ or Rosie or real estate fraud or Todd Croft or frozen accounts. Irene pushes all that away, though during the natural lulls in the conversation, it feels like she's holding an unruly mob behind a door. It feels, as they finish up dinner, like Agent Vasco has just taken a seat at the table. That's how badly Irene wants to talk about it. Instead, she says, "The mother on the boat today thought we were married. She said, 'You have a good man there.' She said she could tell how much you cared for me." The instant these words are out, Irene feels her cheeks burn.
"I hate to break it to you, AC," Huck says. "Everyone who gets on that boat thinks we're married."
He reaches for Irene's hand.
"And everyone can see how much I care for you."
They head back to the boat, hand in hand. There are stars overhead, and it feels like there's a bright, burning star in Irene's chest. What is happening? Huck helps Irene down into the boat. Before he turns on the running lights, he takes Irene's face in his hands and he kisses her. The kiss is sweet but intense, and there is no room for thoughts of anything or anyone else, not even Agent Vasco. Ayers. There's no such thing as a clean breakup, Ayers thinks. When she and Mick hashed it out, Ayers told him exactly how she felt. His infidelity with Bridget was insurmountable. Mick said that he had bumped into Bridget on the ferry, and Ayers believed that. But she still didn't trust him, with Bridget or with anyone else. "I can't do this anymore," she said. Deep down, she acknowledges that the fault is not entirely Mick's. Ayers wanted a chance to be with Baker, and she refused to sleep with him while she was still with Mick. She had only gotten back together with Mick as a way to exact revenge on both Baker and Cash for withholding the truth about who they were. And then once she and Mick and Gordon were back in their routine, Ayers was comfortable, if not particularly happy. Now that she has slept with Baker, and without protection, like an irresponsible idiot, and now that Baker has left to go back to Houston, Ayers is neither comfortable nor happy. She had meant to take it slow and steady with Baker. She had vowed to wait until he came back from Houston to consummate their relationship. But passion and high emotion had ruled, and although their night together had been unforgettable, at least for her, now the anticipation is gone. Baker might decide Ayers isn't worth returning for. Monday morning, there's a knock on her door. Ayers is in bed. Mondays, she's off from both jobs, though she has Maya tonight. Ayers is picking Maya up in town at 6, and they have plans to get takeout from De Colpot. Ayers doesn't like unexpected knocks at her door. Who could it be at 9:30 in the morning? Her landlady? Jehovah's Witnesses? She puts a pillow over her head.
The door is locked. Whoever you are, she thinks, please go away. Monday is her day of rest.
Hello? A voice says, loud and clear. Ayers?
It's Mick. He still has a key. Why didn't she ask for her key back? A second later, there's a flutter of footsteps as Gordon comes running into the bedroom and jumps up on Ayers' bed. Mick is no dummy, she thinks. He sent his goodwill ambassador in first. But Mick soon follows.
Get up, he says.
Ayers flips over and partially opens one eye. What are you doing here? Does she need to remind him that they've broken up? What if she had company?
It's Monday, Mick says. We're going to Christmas Cove. The boat is anchored in Frank Bay. I have rum punch, I have water, I have snacks, I have your snorkel and fins.
It's over, Mick, Ayers says. We're through. Mick sits on the bed and brushes Ayers' hair out of her eyes.
We're not through, he says. We'll never be through.
He looks unreasonably good for Mick. He has a day's worth of scruff, which is how she likes him best, and he's gotten some sun on his face, making his eyes look very green. Gordon has already snuggled against the curve of Ayers' back. Ayers closes her eyes for 1 second and travels back in time to before the disgusting discovery of Bridget, back when Mick and Gordon were her boys, back when life was calm and happy. But she can travel backward only in her mind. In real time, she has no choice but to move forward. Baker. And Floyd, too, she supposes, assuming they come back. I slept with Baker last week, Ayers says. The night we broke up. Mick's eyebrows shoot up in an expression of surprise, and then a split second later, Ayers sees the hurt, which was her aim.
Banker? Wow. You wasted no time.
Ayers props herself up on her elbows. I like him, she says. He's a grown-up. He doesn't lie to me.
Doesn't he? Mick says. He didn't tell you who he was. And his father, Mick whistles, didn't exactly serve as a role model in the honesty department.
Ayers should never have told Mick anything about Baker. He's not his father, she says. I'm nothing like my parents. You're nothing like yours.
Point taken, Mick says. I'm sure you want me to be angry or jealous about your tryst with Banker, and I am.
He takes a couple of deep breaths, and Ayers can see his Irish temper eddying beneath the surface. Baker is bigger than Mick, but Mick is fiercer. If they ever came to blows, Baker would lose.
But I'm glad you got it out of your system. I had my fling, and now you've had yours.
It doesn't work like that, Mick, Ayers says. I didn't do it for revenge. This isn't a tit-for-tat. And by the way, I waited until we were broken up.
You waited, what, an hour? And we aren't really broken up. We had a misunderstanding, and you overreacted. Bumping into Bridget on the ferry doesn't warrant a breakup. Check the relationship rulebook. Ask your friends.
I don't have any friends, Ayers says.
That's what this is really about, Mick says. Banker, money, they're attractive to you because it's a connection to Rosie.
Baker is in love with me, Ayers says.
Oh, really? Mick says. Well, where is he now? Is he here with a pineapple banana smoothie waiting for you in the Jeep? Has he planned the best day off imaginable, complete with a new Jack Johnson Spotify playlist and a solemn promise that we can order the carbonara pizza and the bloomin' onion pizza and the chocolate banana pizza sticks? Did he arrange for Captain Steven from the Singing Dog to play his guitar for 3 hours this afternoon? Did he make a reservation for tonight at the Longboard?
I have Maya tonight, Ayers says.
I know, Mick says. I made the reservation for three people.
Ayers has to give him credit for that. Maya will die of happiness eating at the Longboard with Mick. She loves the lobster tacos. It's over, Mick, Ayers says, though even she can hear that her voice lacks conviction. Go to Christmas Cove by yourself, and when everyone asks where I am, tell them we broke up. Or better still, take Bridget with you so they figure it out on their own.
I called Bex at Rumlines. Mick says I begged her to take Bridget off my hands, but she says she's fully staffed. Then I heard Robert and Brittany at Island Abodes were looking for someone to help out with the villas. Bridget has an interview with them on Thursday.
Poor Robert and Brittany, Ayer says. They're one of the nicest, coolest couples on Island, and they have a cute baby. But it'll be good for Bridget to get a different kind of job. She's a terrible server.
Agreed, Mick says. I wish I'd never hired her. I wish I'd never met her. But what's done is done. She'll be out of the beach bar by next week.
Ayers can't deny it. This news pleases her.
Back to Banker, Mick says. Does he know that you're ticklish right here?
Mick digs his fingers into Ayers' ribs. She shrieks, and soon they're tussling in bed, and Mick crawls on top of her, and she lets him rest on her for a couple of seconds before pushing him off.
I have a surprise for you, Mick says. Two surprises. One for now and one for later. Does Banker know how much you love surprises?
Ayers does love surprises. Okay, she says. I'll come. It's a swan song, she tells herself. A last hurrah. Because she has Maya tonight, there's no danger of her sleeping with Mick. There's no reason they can't go out together in public as friends. The second Ayers sits in Mick's Jeep with Gordon perched in her lap, she feels happy about her decision. The day is crystal clear, sunny, and hot. And what else would Ayers have done with her time? She would have holed up at home and read Rosie's diaries. She has been so engrossed in the story about Russ, she's on the verge of becoming addicted. She has finally gotten to the part where they're reunited. Russ knows about Maya. Rosie knows about Irene and the boys. They're going to be together. It's good for Ayers to leave the diaries alone for a while. She sips the smoothie Mick got her from our market and sings along to Chesney on the radio. This is what a day off is supposed to feel like. Mick turns onto Great Cruise Bay Road, and Ayers says, "Where are we going?"
"Surprise number one," Mick says.
Great Cruise Bay Road is one of Ayers' favorite places. It has views northwest over the Westin toward St. Thomas and Water Island. Mick follows the road almost to the tip of the point. Then he signals and turns into a driveway marked with a sign that says, "Pure Joy." This leads to an adorable white cottage with bright blue shutters. It reminds Ayers of the months that she and her parents spent living on Santorini. They climb out of the car.
"Follow me," Mick says.
He steps up onto the wraparound porch that has an uninterrupted water view. "What are we doing here?"
"This is my new place," Mick says.
"You bought it?"
"Renting," Mick says, "long term. But it's mine. You want to see the rest?"
He leads her inside, and everything is picture perfect. There's a bedroom, living room, dining nook, kitchen, and a brand new sparkling white-tiled bathroom. Every room in the house has a view of the water. On the deck is a grill and a hot tub, and around the corner is an outdoor shower painted the same blue as the shutters. It's a real place. Not a hole in the wall like where Mick lives now, which meant that he was always crashing at Ayers's in a way that felt like he was infringing on her space. For years, Ayers has been begging him to find someplace better. And now he has. This cottage, Pure Joy, is a dream. "This is amazing," Ayers says. "You'll be much happier here."
"We will be happier here," Mick says. "I got it for us. See those chairs?"
He points to two stools, upholstered in blue, in front of a bar counter.
"Those are what convinced me to take it. I pictured the two of us coming home from work late at night and having a drink there together. And can you imagine the sunset from here?"
"Hashtag sunset," Ayers says. "Your Instagram account will blow up."
"We can have our coffee out here in the mornings," Mick says.
"We broke up," Ayers thinks, but Mick's expression is so earnest that she doesn't have the heart to say it. "It's nice," she admits. "One last hurrah," she tells herself again,
though Mick is slowly but surely wearing down her resistance. Her night with Baker, which had seemed so vivid and unforgettable right after it happened, is now fading from her mind. Has she merely fallen prey to the sexual attraction she feels for Baker because it's bright, shiny, and new? Her relationship with Mick is deep and long and intense. Mick is the person Ayers tells things, even the small, inconsequential things, because he's the one who has shared her history. He has context. If she starts something new with Baker, she would have to go back to square one. The thought is, frankly, exhausting. Ayers wades through the crystal water of Frank Bay and climbs into the boat. Mick is borrowing Fun Day, a 32-foot Grady White, from his boss for the day, something he normally does only on special occasions. Mick loads Gordon in and turns up the music, and they go zipping across the surface of the water at breathtaking speed. Ayers loves nothing in the world more than being out on a boat, Treasure Island included, though the experience is much better when she isn't working. She fills a Yeti cup with rum punch. Mick makes the best and belts out, "Save it for a rainy day." It's well known that Monday is the weekend for people in the service industry. La Tapa closes on Monday nights after the holiday rush, as do a bunch of other restaurants. So when Mick and Ayers arrive in Christmas Cove, it's a who's who of St. John hospitality, all rafted together on either side of the pizza pie boat. The guys from 420 to Center are there, and so is Bex from Rum Lines, and Maddie the bartender from the Doghouse Pub with his girlfriend Lindsay, who works at the beach bar with Mick, and Colleen from Pizza Bar in Paradise, and Jenna from Extra Virgin Bistro. Alex the bartender from Ocean 362 is on a catamaran with Skip. From the looks of things, Skip is pretty far along in the partying department. When he sees Mick and Ayers pull in, he raises his arms over his head and hollers at the top of his lungs, "They're here!" as though Mick and Ayers are the king and queen of this particular St. John prom. Ayers grins at everyone and waves. This is her family. Mick and Ayers tie up to a sleek black Midnight Express that has a woman on board who looks familiar. She's wearing a tropical print bikini and enormous sunglasses. She waves and says, "Hey, Ayers!" And then she helps Mick with the ropes and the bumpers, while Ayers racks her brain for how she knows this woman. She leans over to hug Ayers. "I suppose you've heard that Brent and I are getting a divorce?" "Who's Brent?" Ayers thinks. The woman pulls a cigarette and a lighter out of a pair of teensy white shorts lying at her feet, and Ayers realizes the woman is Swan Seeley, the mother of Colton Seeley, Maya's little friend. Swan has traded in her reusable shopping bags and sustainable vegetable gardening for day drinking and lung cancer. Ayers laughs. This is fabulous. She always liked Swan best when she was breaking the rules anyway. But a divorce is sad, right? "I'm sorry to hear that," Ayers says. Swan waves the sentiment and her exhale of smoke away. "Don't be," she says. "He's got a gambling problem. I had to cut bait before he sank us." "Good for you, then." Swan smiles. "There are eligible men everywhere," she says. "Just look at this place." Her eyes scan the now impressive raft of boats. "What about Skip? He's single, right?" "He's single," Ayers says, "but I'm not sure he's your type." Or anyone's type, she thinks. Although who's to say that Skip, who's coming off his weird thing with Tilda, and Swan Seeley, freshly separated, wouldn't be a good match for each other. "There's the hottest new dad at the school," Swan says. "He's brand new to the island, relocating from Houston. I saw him last week when I was picking up Colton. Maya seemed to know him, though of course I couldn't ask who he was with Colton in the car." Hottest new dad. That would be Baker. Ayers feels herself bristling. Naturally, Swan Seeley and all the other Gift Hill mothers will pant over Baker. Ayers wants to inform Swan that Baker is taken by her, but she can't very well do this when she's here with Mick. At that moment, who should step onto Swan's boat but Skip, holding a chilled bottle of Dom Perignon and a bouquet of plastic flutes.
Champagne, ladies?
He pours some for Swan and some for Ayers.
This storied bubbly has notes of Canadian pennies, your dad's members-only jacket, and...
He glances over Ayers' shoulder. We are never, ever, ever getting back together. Why does he keep doing this? Ayers wonders, but Swan laughs.
Ha! You can say that again!
Ayers turns to see a cute little speedboat pull up. Tilda is at the wheel, and Cash is next to her. Ayers is seized with panic. Cash is here? What's Cash doing here? It's obvious, hello, that he came with Tilda. That's her parents' little runabout, though they also have a 62-foot single-hull sailboat. Tilda and Cash? Yes, Baker told her this the other night. It's good. It's great. Tilda and Cash together isn't the problem, except maybe for Skip. The problem is that Cash will see Ayers here with Mick and report back to Baker.
Ugh, Arr, what can she do?
Can she pretend she's here with Swan? Maybe Cash and Tilda won't stay. There are a lot of boats here already. Maybe they want privacy. Maybe they'll head over to Mermaid's Chair where they can be alone, or to Dinghy's on Water Island.
Go to Dinghy's, Ayers thinks.
But Tilda has earned her place at this party. She works just as hard as everyone else. Ayers notices she gets a sadistic grin on her face when she sees Skip. She must want to gloat. Cash and Tilda raft up with Mick. Ayers watches Mick and Cash shake hands. Ayers offers a lame little wave. Captain Stephen starts playing the guitar and singing Southern Cross. Think about how many times I have fallen. Mick's hand lands on the back of Ayers' neck. He knows how much she loves this song. The pizza arrives. One carbonara with lobster, one bloomin' onion drizzled with lemon aioli, and Ayers' ultimate splurge, the chocolate banana pizza sticks. She drinks her champagne. Skip has, generously, left the bottle for her and Swan to split, and she eats some pizza, plays tug-of-war with the crust with Gordon, and dives off the boat for a swim. Tilda and Cash have noodles. They're floating in the water, interested in no one but each other. Mick is gone somewhere. Ayers cranes her neck to see if, by chance, Bridget has arrived on any of the boats. Captain Stephen stops playing, and there's the spine-chilling shriek of microphone feedback. Then she hears Mick's voice.
You guys, can I have your attention, please? Hey, everyone, please quiet down.
Ayers sees Mick heading toward her with a microphone. Is he going to sing to her or ask her to sing? Maybe something from the Jack Johnson Spotify playlist? It all happens so fast. A hush blankets Christmas Cove, and all eyes are on Mick, now standing in the bow of Funday in front of Ayers, who is dripping wet in her bikini. He drops to one knee, and only then does Ayers get it. The second surprise.
This is why I went to St. Thomas, he whispers.
He pulls a box out of the pocket of his swim trunks and says into the microphone so that every single person they work and live with on the tiny island that is St. John USVI can hear.
Ayers Wilson, will you marry me? Will you be my wife?
Ayers isn't sure where Cash is, but she can feel his eyes boring into her. Swan Seeley claps a hand over her mouth, and then everyone starts chanting, Say yes! Say yes! Say yes! Gordon, who never barks, is pressing his flank against Ayers' leg, barking. A public proposal is never a good idea, Ayers thinks. Or is it? She can't say no. She can't dive off the boat and seek asylum on Little St. James Island. She could, she supposes, beg Cash and Tilda to take her back to Cruise Bay. Yes, that's what she should do. But what a buzzkill. What a depressing end to such a well-executed surprise. Ayers realizes that a good number of these people must have been in on it. Nobody knows that Ayers and Mick broke up and that Ayers embarked on a new relationship. They're all caught up in the theatrics.
Rosie?
Ayers thinks with a glance skyward. But there's no answer. Ayers presents her left hand to Mick, and he slips the ring on her finger, then stands and pulls her in for a kiss. The crowd cheers. Ayers studies the diamond. It's a beautiful ring. She has to give him that. The stone sparkles so brightly that Ayers is, temporarily, blinded. Cash. Cash takes a picture of Mick down on one knee, holding out a ring to Ayers. He sends it to Baker with a caption that reads, "She said yes, dude. Sorry." Maybe, just maybe, it was all for show. Cash always wondered about guys who thought it was a good idea to propose during the seventh inning stretch of a Colorado Rockies game, or up on the stage during a Jason Aldean concert. Was it to guarantee a yes, because most women wouldn't say no in front of 20,000 people? But then, later, was the ring pulled off the finger, put back in the box, and taken to the nearest pawn shop? Ayers looked surprised, but not necessarily happy. On the boat ride home, he asks Tilda for her opinion. "She looked dazzled," Tilda says, "in the best possible way. And who can blame her? Those two have been together forever. They've had their issues and come out the other side. They'll get married and have kids. They'll be great parents. They dote on Mick's dog, Gordon." "Okay," Cash says. "Please don't tell me seeing that upset you," Tilda says. "If it did, I'll drop you off at the National Park Service dock right now and you can walk home. Or find another unsuspecting woman to pick you up hitchhiking." "It didn't bother me in the slightest," Cash says, which is true. His feelings for Ayers have changed dramatically in the past few days. "I'm worried for my brother. He really likes her. Maybe I shouldn't have sent him that text." Sure enough, as soon as they get back to Cruise Bay, Cash's phone starts ringing. Baker. Cash sends him to voicemail. He and Tilda are going to her villa to hang out. Then they're heading into town for dinner. La Tapa is closed, so they decide to go to the longboard. Tilda is in the mood for their frozen rosé. And who should they happen across but Ayers, Mick, and Maya, who are enjoying more champagne and platters of tacos. When Maya sees Cash, she jumps to her feet. "Bro," she says, "did you hear the news?"
"I did," Cash says. He smiles at Mick and Ayers. "Congratulations, you two."
Mick puts an arm around Ayers and squeezes her.
"I should have done this a long time ago."
Ayers' expression can only be described as dazed, or maybe she's just drunk. "I meant to text you," she says. "The boat has a mechanical issue and we had to cancel the charter for tomorrow."
"She wouldn't have been able to go anyway," Mick says. "I want to keep her in bed all day."
"Really?" Maya says. "We're eating."
"Yeah," Cash thinks.
The idea of Mick and Ayers in bed is enough to turn his stomach as well. He can feel his phone buzzing away in his pocket. Baker, Baker, Baker.
"Well, if I don't have work," Cash says, "that means we can finally hike to the baobab tree."
"After school?" Maya says. "Can we leave at 4 so my friend Shane can come?"
"Works for me," Cash says.
"And me," Tilda says. "Pick us up at the ferry dock, please," Maya says, "and bring plenty of water."
"Yes, ma'am," Cash says.
"She's a force," Ayers says. Her eyes mist over, just like her mother. At 4 o'clock the next day, Cash and Tilda pick up Maya and Shane in Tilda's Range Rover, which both kids find impressive. Immediately, they start taking pictures of themselves in the back. Cash has probably overprepared for the hike. In his backpack, he has 8 bottles of water, 2 of them frozen, as well as trail mix, 4 Kind bars, 2 spare clean bandanas, and a first aid kit. He and Tilda are both dressed in hiking shorts and boots. Tilda has 6 bottles of water in her pack, plus sunscreen, bug spray, peanut butter-filled pretzels, a selfie stick, and a paper map from the National Park Service.
"You guys are so gung-ho," Maya says.
She holds her phone over her head and snaps a photo of herself making a fish face. We're just gonna hike in our chucks.
Yeah, Shane says. They all climb out of the rover and Shane gives Cash and Tilda the once over. But when I climb Everest, I'm bringing you guys with me.
Smart Alec, Tilda says. Chucks aren't really the proper footwear for a hike, but Maya and Shane have youth and exuberance on their side. They bound down the trail, and in a couple of minutes, they're so far ahead, they're out of sight.
Hey, wait up, Cash calls out. It's not a race.
He would like to look around, take in the scenery, maybe stop to identify some plants, though that clearly isn't happening. So this company I want to start, Tilda says, would provide guides for every hike on the island. You wouldn't need a map, and you'd have someone there to point out the pineapple cactus and the catch and keep, and someone to explain the historical significance of the ruins. The national parks just aren't staffed to keep up with demand.
I should quit Treasure Island and come work for you, Cash says. I'm much more comfortable on land.
We should be partners, Tilda says.
I have no money, Cash says. I might get some once my father's estate is settled.
This isn't something Cash lets himself think about often, but it's always there, twinkling like a star in the distance, a possible inheritance. Sweat equity, Tilda says. Then she nods down the trail. Look. Maya and Shane are up ahead, holding hands. Cash says,
I saw them holding hands last week in town. It's cute, as long as that's all they're doing.
Don't be naive, Tilda says. Do you think that's all they're doing?
Yes, Cash says, because he can't stand to think otherwise. I'm new at this Big Brother thing, but my natural instinct is to be overprotective. If he tries anything more, he'll have me to deal with.
You're adorable, Tilda says. She stops, turns in the middle of the trail, and gives him a kiss. Because they're losing daylight and the mosquitoes are coming out, once they reach the baobab tree by the Seben plantation ruins, they decide to turn around. But first, they give the tree the reverence it deserves. The tree is extraordinary in breadth and height. It's the only one of its kind on the island.
The seeds are edible, Maya says. They were brought over from Africa by the Danish slaves.
They use Tilda's selfie stick to take a picture of the four of them standing at the base of the tree. After Maya inspects the picture, she turns to Shane.
We're a cute couple, she says.
She looks over at Cash and Tilda.
And so are you guys.
She pauses a beat.
You two are a couple, right?
Cash says.
Right, Tilda says, and they all head back up the hill. When they reach the Range Rover, both Cash's and Maya's phones start going nuts. Cash ignores his. It's Baker, of course. Maya does not ignore hers.
Would you guys please drop us in town? She asks after she checks her texts. Are you sure? Tilda says. I'm happy to take you all the way home. I live on Jacob's Ladder, Maya says. Trust me, you do not want to drive the rover up Jacob's Ladder.
You're probably right, Tilda says. Town it is.
And how will you get home from town? Cash asks.
You're being overprotective, Tilda murmurs.
I'm being responsible, Cash says. She's 12.
He looks at Maya in the rearview mirror.
How are you getting home? Shane's parents?
Huck is coming to get me, Maya says. His charter ran late.
Okay, Cash says.
Reluctantly, he pulls his phone out. He has 2 missed calls from Baker and 1 missed call from Ayers, which he hopes is work-related. He shoots her a text. What's up? A second later, she responds.
I need your advice.
No, Cash thinks. He's not getting in the middle of this.
As soon as the kids climb out at Powell Park, Cash reaches over and pulls Tilda in for a kiss. So we're a couple, huh?
Yes, Tilda says. We are.
Cash becomes so lightheaded thinking about this that they get all the way to Jumbi Bay before he realizes that Maya was lying to him. Huck's charter didn't run late. Huck didn't have a charter today. Irene told Cash that this morning. She was home all day. Turn the car around, he says to Tilda. They head back to Powell Park where they dropped Maya and Shane off, but of course the kids are gone. Cash calls Maya and gets her voicemail. What do you want to do? Tilda asks. Loop around, please, Cash says. He hangs out the window of the Rover scanning the ferry dock, which is packed with workers heading back to St. Thomas. Did Maya and Shane get on the ferry? The thought makes Cash ill. They pass the jewelry store, the timeshare office, Slim Man's parking lot. Then Tilda has to make a decision, right toward Drink and Gallows Point, or left past the Lime Inn and De Colpot. Oh, I don't know, Cash says. I should never have let her get out of the car in town. It's just, I knew she and Shane had hung out in town together before, but now it's dark and she lied to me, so she must be doing something she doesn't want Huck to know about. Tilda turns left. They pass the dog house and the longboard and our market and Caps. Then Tilda takes a right and says, maybe they went for pizza. Let's check Ronnie's. Yes, Ronnie's Pizza. Bingo, brilliant, Cash thinks. They're 12. Tilda pulls up out front and Cash runs in, looks around. No Maya, no Shane. She likes Candy's barbecue, Tilda says. I remember Rosie telling me that. Let's swing by, and if she's not there, we'll call Huck. I don't have Huck's number, Cash says. I'll call my mother if she's not at Candy's. Maya is not at Candy's. Cash climbs back into the Rover and stares at his phone. He calls Maya's phone again and again. It goes directly to voicemail. She's ghosting me, he says. Tilda laughs. Maybe. Or maybe her phone died. Or maybe she turned her phone off because she wants to kiss Shane in peace. You're not making me feel any better, Cash says. Sorry, sorry, Tilda says. Okay, let's think. Do you want me to take you home or run you up to Huck's? Home, Cash says. The last thing I want to do is face Huck. When Cash and Tilda arrive at the villa, Irene is sitting at the kitchen table, paging through A House Beautiful. Cash, she says, standing up, and you must be... Tilda, it's nice to meet you, Mrs. Steele. Are you kids hungry? I haven't given a single thought to dinner, though I probably should. It's getting late. Mom, Cash says. He's not sure why he feels so panicked. Maya has probably already made it home. Shane's parents probably came and picked them up. But what if they didn't? Cash should have insisted on taking Maya straight home. She acted like a full-blown teenager, but she's only 12. 12! We hiked the Esperance Trail with Maya and her friend Shane. Oh, that's nice, Irene says. Then she asked us to drop her off in town, Tilda says. She told us Huck would pick her up, Cash says. She told us it wouldn't be an inconvenience because his charter was running late. Wait, Irene says. What? Cash watches Irene snap into parenting mode, and it's like being transported back in time 15 years. Let me call Huck. Irene fishes her cell phone out of her bag and dials. Cash can hear her reach Huck's recording. He's not answering, she says, and I don't want to leave a message and panic him. Maybe Maya is home and they're sitting down to dinner. Maybe, Cash thinks. He pictures Huck and Maya at a table, Maya describing the baobab tree. Cash needs her to be home, to be safe. He can't handle losing anyone else. Huck. When he gets out of the shower, he sees Irene has called. Prayers answered, he thinks. It was bad luck that there had been no charter today. Or maybe it was good luck. Huck isn't sure. Huck has done nothing all day but think about kissing Irene. He kissed her on the boat, then he kissed her in his truck, and finally he walked her up the steps to the villa and kissed her next to the sliding glass door. He thought that maybe, just maybe, he'd get an invitation to come inside, upstairs. But eventually, Irene had put her index finger to his lips and slipped inside alone. He understood. It was too soon to go any further. She was newly widowed, and so much still remained a mystery. But he had hoped. If they'd had a charter, would they have gone back to their normal pre-kiss selves? Would it have been like the kiss never happened? What torture. Huck wouldn't have been able to focus on fishing for one second. Who cared about fishing? Love was the only thing that mattered. He prefers to think there would have been a new energy between him and his first mate, barely sublimated. Huck would brush against Irene, their hands would touch. She would sit next to him behind the wheel of the boat. He would count the hours and then the minutes until the clients were walking away down the dock so that he could kiss Irene again. People would assume they were newlyweds. It's been so long since Huck has felt this way about a woman that he hardly recognizes himself. He feels 25 again. But they hadn't had a charter, and so Huck was left in a vacuum of solitude. He wanted to call Irene and invite her to do something. There was a new floating taco bar in the East End called Lime Out. They could drive to Hanson Bay, rent a kayak, and paddle out for tacos. Would Irene like that? Or maybe a simple lunch would be better at Aqua Bistro in Coral Bay. Huck could introduce Irene to Rupert. But no, Rupert would be smitten immediately and Huck would have to beat him back. In the end, Huck lay in his hammock and finally finished the Connolly book. After enjoying a brief sense of accomplishment, he'd stared at his damn phone, willing it to ring, willing it to be Irene inviting him to the villa for a swim in the pool. 3 o'clock didn't even provide its usual respite, because Maya was going hiking with Cash, so she didn't need a ride home from school. Huck figured Maya would be hungry when she got home, and so at 5:30, he went to Candy's for barbecue. Then he got the text from Destiny about the next day's charter, and he assumed Irene had received it too. They would be together tomorrow on the boat. Huck tried Maya to get her ETA, but was delivered straight to her voicemail. She always let her phone run down at the end of a day. It was frustrating. He decided to take a shower. And now that he's out, he can see he has 2 missed calls, both from Irene, which at this time of day is strange and maybe troubling. Maya? Huck calls out, but there's no answer. Huck pokes his head out into the hallway. The house is quiet. Maya's bedroom door is open. She's not home yet, but she should be any second, so his privacy is limited. He closes the bedroom door and prepares to call Irene back, but something stops him. She has called twice without leaving a message, so clearly there's something she wants to tell him in person. He fears, he can barely say the words in his mind, that the kissing changed things for the worse, and that Irene no longer feels she can work on the boat. He'll be crushed. He has relived the kissing so many times in the past 21 hours that it has taken on the quality of a dream. Irene was enthusiastic about kissing him back, right? In his mind, she has her hands in his hair. She's pulling him closer, wanting the kiss to be deeper. But Huck had been drinking, and he has seen far too much on the news not to have doubts about even the most consensual seeming of acts. Huck shouldn't have gotten so carried away. There was a moment at the villa where he'd wanted very badly to press his body against hers, but he hadn't done it. There had been the impulse and then maybe the start of a movement, but he'd stopped himself in time. Still, he worries she read his mind, sensed the power of his urges, and now is afraid and maybe even repulsed by him and thinks that working together is no longer a good idea. In fact, it's inappropriate. In fact, the friendship has to go as well. As Huck is spiraling down into bleaker and bleaker depths, his phone rings. It's Irene. Hard things are hard, he thinks. He'll just have to apologize and promise to be a gentleman from here on out. But he cannot let her quit. Hello, he says, as jolly as Santa Claus. Huck, she says, it's Irene. I already knew that, he says, the marvel of cell phones. I'm calling to see if Maya has made it home, Irene says. What? Huck says. He's confused. Not yet, no. Why? I thought she was with Cash. Oh, dear, Irene says. Huck hangs up the phone, calls Maya, gets her voicemail, then climbs into his truck and slams the door so hard his ears ring. Late charter? Since when has Huck ever come home late from a charter? Never, that's when. He wants to wring Cash Steele's neck.